This is Charlotte Tux. I'm Mike Collins. Today we take a walk on the wild side with two botanists. Wait a minute. Does that sentence make sense? Oh, in this case, yes, it does. Larry Mellencamp and Paula Gross have done a lot of research and written a book about bizarre botanicals, the circus clowns, magicians, and tattooed ladies of the plant world. And what they have to say may make us see the world around us a little differently and may change what you decide to plant in your garden. Larry Mellencamp is a professor of botany and horticulture at UNC Charlotte. Paula Gross is an assistant director of UNC Charlotte's Botanical Gardens. And welcome back to the program, both of you.
Thank you, Mike. We're glad to be here.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. You're both botanists. You know a lot about plants. What made you collaborate to talk about strange plants, or what, as you call them, weird and wonderful plants?
We were asked by Timber Press to produce a book on freaks of nature.
Which we protested.
Yeah, we didn't want to call these plants freaks because they're not freaks. They're perfectly natural and normal in their own right. Uh-huh. They live in nature. They're part of the web of life. It's just that they do things a little bit differently. And they go through their pollination or their growing and making seeds. They just do it a little differently from other plants, and so they're weird.
Yeah.
But they're not free. A freak is a deformity, an abnormality, something that's not natural.
Well, why did they want a book about the freaks of nature in the first place?
To stimulate interest.
To sell books.
Yeah, exactly. We're interested in strange things like that. The same reason we go to the circus or the fair, right, to see something different.
Well,
or why does someone have a pet tarantula? It's just the odd, the bizarre. We're fascinated with the macabre. We're fascinated with something that's a little bit different, the rare, the unique. So.
And you say in the book that the you characterize these plants as the circus clowns, magicians, tattooed ladies of the plant world, and you say you focus on them for the same reason that most people focus on tattooed ladies and magicians in the real world, because they come from strange places.
Strange places and do strange things, although some are right here under our very noses growing in the woods around here. Hearts of Burston, mm-hmm, is a native plant. Piggy's Ginger is a native plant. People grow Love Lies a Bleeding in their gardens, bleeding hearts in their,
right,
gardens. Corpse flowers you can grow in your gardens here.
Well, I was going to ask if there are things about these plants, because some of them are not necessarily native, or they're out there and far away from where the population is. That's obviously what our fascination is,
right,
with them. Are there places in the world where these things are just taken for granted and not viewed as freaks of nature or circus clowns, etc.?
Well, that's a good point.
I think absolutely. I think it's a matter of perspective. A lot of these tropical plants in here that are so bizarre to us in the tropics would be, I grow that in my yard. Everybody's got one of those. So, mm-hmm, it's a little bit matter of perspective.
Now, the UNC Charlotte Botanical Garden is famous for Titan Arum, if that's how you say it, or Bella.
We named her Bella.
Yeah, we came out and did a program with you, and unfortunately, Bella, although I think was in bloom, she was beyond her peak, and she didn't stink quite as badly as we were hoping for.
Yes, the Titan Arum only.
Bad for you.
She's only fragrant for the first morning, and after that, no more stink.
Okay. Well, that's probably fortunate for us, because I'm not sure we had stomachs strong enough to withstand it. But it is a marvelous plant. The bloom is just incredible, stink or not.
It's the world's most fabulous plant, because it's so unusual, it blooms so infrequently, it lasts such a short period, and it does such strange thing with that strong stink.
Well, it was as tall as I am, and I'm 6 feet tall.
Wow.
And that was just the flower.
Yeah.
So it is the largest inflorescence in the world, and it smells like rotting flesh. So how could it not be wonderful?
So it's not an exaggeration, because I noticed that in the book that you called this the world's most fabulous plant. It's not an exaggeration to say that. It's not just because you have one.
We don't think so. Whenever they bloom, which is rare, mm-hmm, they cause a stir. They're only in bloom for 3 days, and so people have to come see them quickly. And so,
yes,
crowds gather, and that makes them fabulous, makes them something to look forward to, makes them something to talk about, makes them wonder why. What makes you wonder why it does that.
How often do they bloom? Because we were out there a couple of years ago for the blooming event, and I thought, well, this is going to be it for a long, long time. And then I read in the paper this summer it was blooming again.
It bloomed back in June. About every 3 years is what they could do on a regular basis.
Now, most of us like plants. We are certainly surrounded by plants. Many of us garden. Many of us have lots of houseplants. We like them. You are excited by plants.
Well,
of course, you're a botanist. Why wouldn't you be? That's why you're a botanist. But why are you excited by them, and when did this excitement for the two of you begin?
Well, plants are around us, and we take them for granted. So we're like cheerleaders for plants. We need to call attention to plants, to people, so they don't take them for granted. They look for the odd and the unusual, to have a little excitement. Because we're surrounded by green plants, by shrubbery, by masses of petunias and coleus, we kind of take them for granted. We love to see them, and we need masses of plants in our gardens, but we occasionally need something to stand out and attract our attention, a little special.
Well, I'm excited by plants because it's never ending, your study of them. There are so many of them that as soon as you discover one thing, it leads you to another and another. There's hardy plants that you can grow in your garden. There's tropicals. There's orchids. There's succulents. You live your whole life and you never explore the whole world of plants. So it's something that is almost infinite.
When you say you discover something new, is it a new plant, a new species, or something new about a plant you already know about?
Oh, both. Yes, but I was mostly referring to a new species, a different type of plant. But the more you delve into plants, some of them have fascinating stories. The most lowly plant, the more you dig into it, you find that uses of people medicinally for the plant, how people may have used it to eat, and all various
properties.
Exactly, uses of plants. And then you get into their physiology. How do they do what they do? How does a plant grow? What chemicals does it make? So it's endless.
Why? Do we know why there are so many different varieties of plants? I mean, why do we have so many? Why do we need so many?
Well, I don't know that we...
I'm not complaining, mind you. I'm just
asking. We don't realize that we need them. They're part of the natural world, just like there are a lot of different animals. There are a lot of different plants because there's so many niches where they can grow. Habitats all around the world. High mountains, deep jungles, deserts. Ravines, strange climates, hot, dry, wet. Organisms have evolved to grow in all of these different places.
But what is it? And, you know, we understand plants that have root systems and that we water every day or need water to survive. But there are plants that don't need water to survive. There are plants that really don't live in the ground. They are up in the air someplace.
That's correct. Spanish moss. Down at the coast, you drive down to the beach and you see the Spanish moss festooning the trees.
So it makes you wonder how and why these plants developed, because they're not part of the real plant. Well, they are part of the real plant world, but they're not like normal everyday plants like trees and grass and philodendron.
Right.
They develop because they can, because they found a place to live. It's the sort of will to survive and evolve. And if there's a niche to be had by the plant, it's going to find it. And because plants are the foundation of life on Earth, that they really are everywhere, that whatever niche there is, they're going to find a way to live in it.
You use the word evolve. Are plants a good way to talk about evolution? Do plants evolve more quickly than mammals or reptiles?
No, can't say that. Since the beginning of life on Earth, plants and animals have gone through changes. And plants have evolved just like animals. They've come from primitive plants through ferns, pine trees, cycads, flowering plants, just like animals have gone from fish to amphibians to reptiles, dinosaurs, birds, and mammals. Plants have evolved hand in hand along with animals down through the millions of years of history.
Why are ferns primitive? Because they were here first?
They were here first, and they're primitive because they reproduce solely by spores and not from seeds and that come from flowers. Ferns do not make seeds, and that's a primitive trait, similar to the fact that amphibians have to lay their eggs in the water. That's a primitive trait. Whereas reptiles lay eggs on land. That's an advanced trait. So scientists who studied plants and animals have taken all the data, I guess, and come to conclusions of what's more primitive, what's more advanced, and we've come up with an array of things that seem to fit the data, the observations.
So in your book, you ask a question that I was going to ask anyway, and that question is, so what's a weird plant? I'm going to let you answer that question, or try to.
So this is how we began when we decided we were going to do the book and we were going to do it together. Our first conversation was, what is a weird plant? So we had to start filtering through all the plants that we know and asking people. We asked people, what do you think is weird? What do you think is bizarre? And so it's a very hard question to answer. It's a personal question. Ask somebody, you know, what is a weird person or a weird food? It depends on your perspective.
The most commonly brought up weird plant was the pineapple.
Really?
Common grocery store pineapple is considered weird.
Why?
Because we don't have them around here growing wild. They come from an exotic place.
They come from a can. Come on.
And you see, that's kind of the point. People have an opinion like that, that they think they understand, but when you explain that these come only from Brazil and that the pineapple itself consists of dozens of small fruits that are fused together into one big fruit, then it starts getting unusual. It doesn't fit our normal understanding.
And when you see it growing on the plant, it's got a vegetative part, leaves, then there's a fruit, and then there's more leaves on top. It's a very odd sort of arrangement.
You said it was only from Brazil. I swear to you, I thought they came only from Hawaii.
That's where they have been taken to grow in mass production. They originally came only from eastern Brazil.
Is there a difference in taste between the Brazilian pineapple and the Hawaiian
pineapple? Well, I think depending on where they're grown, there are different strains that could, growing in different soils, could have slightly different taste. But we're used to the, you know, the Dole pineapple that we've come to know for a generation or more, and that's what we consider
which has
standard.
A uniform taste. Somehow they make it all taste exactly the same.
They make them all taste the same.
Which was why it was such a revelation when I tasted my first fresh-cut pineapple. It was a completely different taste.
Exactly.
So you asked yourself, to get ready for this book, what makes a plant weird? How did you decide? What was the criteria that you used for the, what is there, 77, 97?
85.
85 plants.
It had to be plants that did not look like our everyday plants. We did not want plants that look like phlox, petunia, marigold, sunflower, the things that we know and understand as familiar plants. Mm-hmm. So we were looking for the things that in fact, attract people's attention who visit the botanical gardens.
Exactly. We had data. We had informal data from visitors to the gardens. What do people react to? Because we have quite a diversity of plants over there. Mm-hmm. And so we were familiar with what people reacted to. Like, what is that? Why does it do that? Why does it look like that? And also then the plants that have behaviors. We think of plants as being immobile. Mm-hmm. And, of course, some plants do move. And so that was another
thing. Well, I'm going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Paula Gross is with us. Was Larry Melichamp. They're both with UNC Charlotte, and they both written together Bizarre Botanicals, How to Grow String of Hearts, Jack in the Pulpit, Panda Ginger, and Other Weird and Wonderful Plants. We're going to put pictures up of some of these plants on our website. We have some plants on the desk, which we'll talk about. They are also on the website. Stay with us.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Acura in Charlotte, offering new and pre-owned MDX, RDX, and TSX models during the Season of Reason through January 3rd. Customized leases and financing available. HendrickAcura.com for more information. Well, tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, a conversation about the men behind the Constitution. We'll speak with the authors of Signing Their Rights Away, the fame and misfortune of the men who signed the United States Constitution. When Charlotte Talks, tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE and at WFAE.org. Well, it should be a pretty day today, high of around 55 and partly cloudy, but tomorrow, right now at least, 100% chance of rain and heavy rain and wind, high of around 50. But then the sun returns on Wednesday, mostly sunny with a high of 51.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, more than 1 million bats have died from white nose syndrome in the past 4 years. What's causing the disease? How a declining bat population affects the environment and U.S. economy, and prospects for a cure.
Tune in to Diane Rehm from 10 to noon here on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about bizarre botanicals. That's also the name of a brand-new book by our guest this morning, Larry Melichamp, who is the professor of botany and horticulture at UNC Charlotte, and Paula Gross, assistant director of UNC Charlotte's Botanical Gardens. We were talking about how the weird plants made the cut. By the way, I need to mention this again, that we have pictures of the plants that they brought today. We've just taken photographs of these plants that are sitting on the desk. There are pictures of the plants, some of the plants that appear in this book on our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks, or you can go to our Facebook page to see these. And some of these have never been seen before, so we will talk about that in a second. But I want to get back to this, the criteria that you used for inclusion, and you began, and you devote a large section of the book, in fact, to carnivorous plants. That's what the publisher wanted.
That was the first thing they wanted, a book on carnivorous plants, because everybody thinks they're weird, and they are. A plant that eats insects is not your everyday plant.
But that's all they eat, right? I mean, we've seen a lot of Hollywood movies where people get eaten, and of course, there's little Shop of Horrors.
That's correct. Those inspirations for those movies down through the ages certainly have come from carnivorous plants. I give a lecture on the myth of the man-eating plant, where we look at old pictures from Hollywood advertising that shows.
Isn't it conceivable that someplace out there in the deep dark jungle that there could be a man-eating plant? I mean, if it eats flies and other.
No, and I'll tell you why. Okay. Humans have come on the evolutionary scene too recently. Humans are fairly young as far as organisms go, and all carnivorous plants have been around a whole lot longer than humans, and so these plants were not evolved to eat something as big as a human. It would take a lot of digestive juice to devour. If you think about it, when a lion eats you, they tear you up in little pieces. They don't just swallow you whole.
Right.
And plants don't have the ability to tear their food apart. They have to swallow it whole and then digest it later.
Well, now there's a picture of a carnivorous plant.
Yeah, there's a Venus flytrap there.
All right. I guess it's our website. Is that where that is coming from, our website? Or it's coming from Facebook. And it has little.
Their jaw.
It looks like teeth and jaws.
That's a bear trap. Mm-hmm. And it snaps shut when an insect goes inside. And then it tightens and squeezes the insect. And then it secretes digestive juice like stomach acid, dissolves the soft parts, and absorbs nutrients from it just like our bodies do. And that helps them grow in their nutrient poor habitat.
How long does that process take?
Several days, depends on how big the insect is.
So does it stay closed?
Tightly closed, and actually drools. It'll actually ooze a little bit of saliva, so to speak, out of the mouth of the jaws while it's digesting.
And you said that it dissolves the soft parts, but you know, a wasp or a fly has hard parts. The wings, I think, are probably not digestible.
Wings and the body.
Casing, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what happens to that? Does it spit it out after it's
done? Almost. The trap opens back up again, and the dead, dried husk of the insect is laying in there to look at, and maybe it blows away, washes away, or maybe it just stays there
indefinitely.
Until the leaf dissolves away in the winter.
And this is a plant that has many of these jaw-like devices on it. It's not just one per plant. It's many. Correct?
Yes, the Venus flytrap typically could have 6 to 10 leaves at any given time.
So many of them could be eating.
That's correct.
Or not eating.
They under ideal conditions during the warm summers when they grow, they'll make one new trap a week if they're being well fed.
What is it in an insect's body that makes for good nutrition for a plant that you would think would need nitrogen from the soil and water from the soil? What is it in an insect's body that it's taking?
It's the same things. It's nitrogen and phosphorus, the very nutrients that we're looking for as micronutrients. They're looking for nitrogen and phosphorus because that's what's limiting in their habitat.
How does a plant know that a fly is good for them? Why, if a plant is developing in a nutrient-poor area, A, why is it developing? And B, how does it then know, there's nothing in the soil, so let me grab that fly?
Well, the plants don't know that they're doing that, and it didn't evolve with a purposeful direction. But it was a gradual process over many years where certain members of a population were able to catch an insect and digest it, and those that did that survived better. And Charles Darwin studied the Venus flytrap, and he made some of the first answered questions about how Venus flytrap and sundews did what they did and why they did what they did. And he couldn't answer that question either. Nobody knows why. We just know that they are able to do it. And because they can do it, it gives them an advantage in nature.
The Venus flytrap, you would think, would be this exotic plant that grows in Africa or the jungles of the Amazon. But no, it's from here. Am I right? It grows within an 80-mile radius of Wilmington. That's
correct.
Its native habitat.
Southeastern North Carolina and adjacent South Carolina.
How do you explain that?
It's inexplicable. Some years ago, I was contacted by a guy who was studying extraterrestrial life. And he had postulated that Venus flytraps came here on a meteor.
Yeah, maybe.
And I tried to tell him that that was not true. These were not extraterrestrial.
How do you know?
That's a good question. That's why they're bizarre.
But why just that part of the country? Why not elsewhere?
The soil is right.
It grows nowhere else in the world natively.
That's correct. Nowhere else native. They can be grown if you take them somewhere,
right.
But that's where they evolved, and they haven't had the ability to spread far and wide.
And you call this one of the most famous and beloved weird plants in the world, given the significantly small radius in which it grows, area in which it grows. How did it become so?
Well, Darwin started it. He called it the most wonderful plant in the world because it moved so fast, and that was unusual. And that notion has simply spread down through the ages.
I argue that it's the plant itself, that it doesn't really need public relations. It itself is so fascinating and bizarre that once, you know, news of plants could be spread, and every time a new part of the world was discovered by the Europeans, there was this flurry of activity about what plants were found there. I mean, people used to be a lot more excited about.
There were a lot of amateur botanists.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, once the Venus flytrap got out there and stories of it were told, it sort of sold itself.
Now, the Green Swamp Preserve in southeastern North Carolina is the most diverse place on Earth for carnivorous plants. Is that where this plant,
That's correct. Venus flytrap is from the Green Swamp Preserve is just a part of the landscape down towards Wilmington. The whole Wilmington region harbors as many as 20 species of different carnivorous plants.
Why?
It's the combination of soil, rainfall, fire, and we don't know.
Does it have something to do with the number of insects available?
Well, because it's a wetland, plenty of insects, you know, are found there. It's a humid place. It has a high rainfall. It has a diverse. It's you might ask, why are there so many African animals on the plains in northern Africa and Kenya? Why are there elephants and giraffes and lions and hyenas and rhinoceroses and all of those things there? Mm-hmm. It's because they find a home there together that suits their needs, and somehow that's where they are left from what may have been a much wider range at one time. That's where we see them today because it suits their needs.
Does this wide variety of carnivorous plants that exists in the Green Swamp Preserve in North Carolina, do they all eat the same thing, or they have different appetites?
That's a good question. The simple answer is they eat different things so they don't compete with each other. The tall pitcher plants catch things that are flying a foot and a half off the ground, and the lowly Venus flytrap catches things that are crawling on the ground. And then there are other pitcher plants that might be a foot tall. There are butterworts that are 6 inches tall. And then there are aquatic carnivorous plants that are living in the water.
Now, these pitcher plants, for those who don't know, are stems that have as it goes up higher, the stem is hollow.
It's a hollow leaf.
And it has kind of a hood on the top of it.
Yes, that's to keep out rainwater. And these catch insects attracted by nectar, and they fall in, can't get out. They accumulate in the tube of the leaf and are digested in there. So this is sort of like a plant intestine. It's an elongated structure that accumulates food, digests the food, and absorbs the food.
What a way to go, huh?
One of our favorite things to do when we have tours is to cut one open. So we cut the leaf open and show you what the plant has been digesting.
And?
Because you can see that.
Are you going to do it right now?
We're going to do it right now.
We should get Aaron in here to take a photograph of this so that we can put it up on our website.
We're cutting open this.
Slow down.
So similarly to the way that school children like to dissect owl pellets and see what was eaten, you can cut open it.
Now we're going to take a photograph of
a pitcher plant.
And we'll put it on the website here. Let's see.
And you can see the contents.
Oh, my. Those are the undigested carcass, the indigestible carcasses of animals.
Wasps.
Yeah. They look like wasps or yellow jackets or moths. Or they could be ladybugs.
Sometimes granddaddy long legs.
So at one point, this is going to fill up. Does it then die?
Oh, that's a good question. During the growing season, the tubes do accumulate insects. And when winter comes, cold weather kills the leaf. It dies down to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It rots and returns more of that nutrient to the soil.
Mm. Now, I want to get back to this movement because I'm not sure what you meant by the fact that these Venus flytraps and other carnivorous plants do what they do by moving. Do you mean they actually move along the ground or they move to catch their prey?
They move to capture their prey. And most carnivorous plants don't move. They attract their prey through flash and other...
Like these pitcher plants.
Exactly, exactly. And then it's like a trap or a pitfall trap. So the insect goes and is attracted and slips in and doesn't come back out. But the Venus flytrap itself does, in fact, move.
What triggers the Venus flytrap to close? Is it a chemical reaction? What is it?
It's physical, chemical. There are little trigger hairs down inside the trap surface. And when a wasp or other insect touches those little hairs, it stimulates a nerve, like a nerve impulse, that causes the trap to react. And what happens is the cells lose turgor pressure and they... change their orientation and causes the two sides of the trap to come together quickly.
Huh.
It's quite a phenomenon that's perhaps unprecedented in the world.
Wow. You also brought the flower of a black orchid?
This is a black orchid. We were talking about travels to the far reaches of the world over the past 200 years and people bringing back strange plants. One of the great myths of all time were the stories of the black orchid from remote lands. And these would be magical, mythical, who knows what. But there never was a black orchid discovered in the wild. There's probably no such thing as a black orchid in the wild. But the black orchid that we picture for the first time ever was a man-made, a hybrid made from wild plants. And it's one of the... perhaps only examples in the book of something that truly does not grow on its own in the wild. It's man-made.
You were saying to me before we started here that it does something similar to what these other carnivorous plants do.
Exactly. It has movement. The bee, when he goes into the flower seeking nectar, touches trigger hairs, and they cause a spring-like explosion, like a mousetrap springing shut. And flings the pollen mass onto the head of the bee.
So with a natural glue that literally sticks to your finger, and you shake your finger and you cannot get it off. You have to scrape it off.
So how does that help the plant if it won't?
Oh, because it's shooting the pollen sacs onto the insect, and it's just the base of them that sticks. And then when the insect goes to visit another flower, it's designed such that as it crawls in and then backs out, the little pollen sacs hook into a pouch, and as it kind of backs out, then the pollen sacs break off, but the sticky pad stays on.
When a mousetrap goes off, you have to reset it.
Yes.
Who resets the trap?
Excellent question. These only work once.
Yep.
Each flower works once. And what the advantage to the plant is that it puts thousands of pollen grains onto one insect, and then the force of the action chases the insect away. It's like you've punched the bee in the face, and that scares the bee away.
But
and so
it's,
he leaves.
It's done its job.
It's done its job. It's picked up pollen, and so it leaves mad and goes to another flower seeking nectar.
They have short memories.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes, they do.
And then it transfers that pollen to the next flower that it visits.
The black orchid is one of three plants that have photographs in your book, Bizarre Botanicals, that are photographs of plants that have never been published. Is that, am I getting that right?
Correct. The black orchid is the first one. The second one is the artillery plant. It's a little house plant that at the right time of year when it's in bloom sends up puffs of pollen that look like smoke from firing cannons off in the distance. And it's fun to sit and watch the plants do that.
What triggers that?
Moisture. We spray them with a little water, and that causes the ripe stamens to explode and puff their pollen up in the air. So this would happen during a little rainstorm in nature. And then the third plant are the explosive spores of the club moss. The spores have oils in them that when they're thrown onto a lighted flame, an open flame, they explode suddenly and give a burst of light.
Really? And so that's the pyrotechnic spores?
Pyrotechnic spores. These are the spores that were used back in the 1800s for the first photographic flash.
So that little tray
with the pile of stuff on it, started out as fern relative spores.
How did they collect them?
By hand, thousands of people going out and collecting little tiny cones of spores from little plants that grow on the ground.
That must have been terribly expensive.
Labor was cheap then.
Okay. But why, I can understand being able to use that for photographic purposes in the 1800s, but why did it develop within the plant? What's the point?
That's a good question. Well, the spores are not meant to explode into flames for the plant. The purpose of the oils in the plant are to allow those spores to be long-lived. They're stored energy for the plant.
Some of these plants that we're talking about, photographs exist now on our website and on our Facebook page, and we'll continue to talk about more of these bizarre botanicals with Larry Melichamp and Paula Gross when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance journalism excellence in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. Well, coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, more than 1 million bats have died from white nose syndrome in the past 4 years. What's causing the disease and how a declining bat population affects the environment and the U.S. economy. And then in hour two, Diane Keaton, the Academy Award-winning actress, discusses her new memoir, focusing on the close relationship she had with her mother. That's all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon here on WFAE.
What a year it's been with Congress and its partisan way.
They went right up to the day when the Treasury Department said it could no longer legally pay the government's bills. Ultimately, it was resolved with the creation of that super committee, and we all know how that went.
I'm Bob Moon, the year in review. First up, Washington, D.C. Next time on Marketplace from APM, American Public Media.
And tune into Marketplace starting at 6:30 here on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Paula Gross, Assistant Director of UNCC's Botanical Gardens. I'm not supposed to say UNCC anymore, am I? Larry Mellichamp is Professor of Botany and Horticulture at UNC Charlotte. And both of them have written a book called Bizarre Botanicals, How to Grow String of Hearts, Jack in the Pulpit, Panda Ginger, and Other Weird and Wonderful Plants, many of which they have brought to us today, many of which we have photographs of on our website and on Facebook. And you're being invited out to the UNC Charlotte Botanical Garden to see some of these plants. They have carefully labeled them and put them on display, and that's better than any photograph can do justice. Let me tell you, seeing these in 3D is very different from seeing them in 2D, even though the photographs in the book are really pretty wonderful. Let's take a phone call. Ron in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. We have a mutual friend, Dr. Mellencamp, that grows Venus flytraps. I grow them myself. I've grown them in planters for about 8 or 9 years now, and I used to get them, you know, when I was a kid down at the beach in the dime store, and you'd bring them home and put hamburger meat in them or stick them with a toothpick to get them to close, and they would always die.
Right.
And then since I've bought these, there's a place down near Holden Beach called the Fly Trap Farm, I think.
Correct.
I've been instructed, you know, to water them with only distilled water or rainwater, and grow them in Canadian sphagnum peat moss.
Sure. They like acidic soil. It needs to stay moist, and so the peat moss stays moist. We've used Charlotte City water for 30 years with no ill effect. So if you have pretty good water, you can use city water. If your water is hard, you would want to use rainwater. But the two secrets to success with them, one is to give them plenty of sunlight. They're not really good house plants,
yeah,
unless you have really bright light. And giving them hamburger gives them indigestion.
Really?
It stimulates overproduction of digestive juices, and they'll actually kill themselves.
Right.
So it's better to give them natural food, such as flies, small bees, wasps, spiders. It's a good way to get the kids out of the house. Go catch some flies for the fly trap, that gives them something to do for a while.
I gave them hamburger when I was a kid, but I've learned not to do that.
That's correct. We instruct kids not to feed them food.
How about pepperoni, chicken?
No, they need flies.
don't they need something to be wiggling?
Wiggling is good, although you can immobilize the fly just so that you can handle it. Mm-hmm. And when you put it into the trap, you still must touch the trigger hairs twice.
Is it a painful death for the fly?
We think it is. If you could see the expression on their little faces during the digestion process, you would take glee. In fact, this is why I think Timber Press wanted us to write this book. They wanted us to appeal to that macabre,
Who are these people?
They said there are people out there who want to know about what's going on inside of the carnivorous plant, and we're all interested in that. We all, you know, we're interested in roadkill. We're interested in horror movies, slasher movies, the myth of the man-eating plant movies, the Little Shop of Horrors notion of a plant eating somebody. We're fascinated by that.
Right. Feed me, Seymour. Ron, thank you for your call. I appreciate
it.
Email says, we're here in coastal Georgia and have always found carnivorous plants in our roadsides and forests forever. Fly traps and others. I've transplanted them to our home. I'm sure we've seen them some 70 miles inland. And he's writing from St. Simons, Georgia.
Sure. Along the coastal regions from southeastern Virginia, down to Florida, and then westward all the way to Texas, in the coastal wetlands, are carnivorous plants. The Venus flytrap is only found in the Carolinas, but there are sundews, pitcher plants, butterworts all throughout this region.
And Jason on Facebook writes, I have found Venus flytraps in Camden, South Carolina. Is that outside the range of the 80-mile range from
where? Yes, barely. Okay. There may be some suitable habitats left.
And because these plants are so fascinating, people have planted them in other places. And there are a few pockets of what they may think are naturally growing plants, but they were planted there.
Throughout the book, you give growing tips and you tell people how difficult they are or how easy they are to grow.
Yes, we rate them one, two, or three difficulty ratings.
Are Venus flytraps?
Venus flytraps are a two. They're a medium. As long as you keep them moist and sunlight, they're easy to grow.
Now, we've had other botanists on and people who deal with plants tell us that we should discourage growing non-native species of plants for many reasons. Bringing a Venus flytrap to your backyard, is that a good idea?
One of the reasons for not growing, let me say that positively, if you bring in exotic plants, they could escape and take over like kudzu has done. And there are many, many non-native plants that have done that. And we definitely discourage the use of plants like that in the landscape where plants could get out into the woods and go wild. Venus flytraps, because their habitat needs are so specific, they need sunlight and constant moisture 365 days a year.
And acidic soil that's not the right kind of soil in our landscape.
Right. Those are not going to take over here. They're too small.
Yeah, sorry.
Now, less people believe this entire conversation than this entire book is about Venus flytraps and other carnivorous plants. It is not. So let's move on to some other plants that are very odd and weird and wonderful in their own way. The devil's claw or unicorn plant. Now, I saw a picture of this in your book. The picture does not do justice to this thing. This thing looks vicious, and it looks kind of like an antelope skull.
It is vicious. It's a seed pod that has two long curved prongs that are quite sharp, and they're designed to attach around the leg of a desert antelope or deer, and by doing that, they get dispersed across the desert landscape.
These are about 4 inches long, right?
Four to 5 inches.
Yeah, and they do look like an antelope skull because they've got those
long horns. They've got two prongs, yes.
As the animals are walking through the landscape,
yes.
They
stumble upon these where they're maturing. They're like beggar's lice and tick seed. As we walk through our woodlands, we get these little seeds on our pants, legs, and carry them around. These are a little bit more aggressive in that they have to attach to a larger animal.
Now, we have several pictures of these on our website and our Facebook page, and one of them we took just prior to the show, and you have this thing gripping your forearm to give you an idea of what the size of this thing is. These animals encounter these, and they can't get them off.
They can't get them off.
And it drives them crazy?
It drives them crazy.
Is it painful?
Is
it just annoying?
They are sharp like a pen. It would be like having a little pen stuck in your arm.
So I thought they would just attach, and as the animal walked around, the seeds would drop out. That's what I got from your book. But before the show, you told me, Paul, that it's a little more gruesome than that.
Well, it can be more gruesome than that. That if they can't get them off, and they wear themselves out running around trying to get these things off, and maybe the animal's a little sick as anyway, and they eventually collapse into a heap, run themselves to death, rot, and provide a great source of fertilizer for this antelope plant.
How amazing is that?
It sounds like a gruesome plot on the part of the plant to get itself dispersed, to get itself some fertilizer, to get itself carried around the habitat at the expense of the animal.
Right.
And it really is, to be a little bit anthropomorphic, it is a plot. It's a ploy on the part of the plant that has worked over the centuries. And because it works, it keeps reproducing itself because these things work.
Mm-hmm.
If they didn't work, like any product, nobody would buy them and they would die out. But these work, and so they do carry on and reproduce.
And we think we're in control of plants, but if you look closer, plants are in many ways controlling us.
That's correct. We're being manipulated by plants.
Those devious little you-know-what.
Oh, I know.
Look at the common apple.
Really?
We've carried apples all around the world and developed many varieties of apples and spread apples far beyond their original range.
But it's a symbiotic relationship.
It's a symbiotic relationship.
Okay.
It's a symbiotic relationship. That's a good point.
Okay. Chris in Charlotte writes, can you ask the panel if these plants do well with grow lights when natural sunlight is not available?
Grow lights are fine as long as they're bright and you leave them on maybe 18 hours a day.
I think most people don't realize that inside your house is really not that bright. And so if you grow something with a grow light, it has to be quite close to that grow light.
Okay. Laura writes, please hurry and get to the angle wing begonia.
Okay, that's the.
Now, obviously, she's been on our website because she saw that we had a picture of an angle wing begonia.
Yeah, the angel wing
angel
begonia.
Wing, excuse me, mm-hmm. misspelled it.
This is probably, as we were talking about earlier, how we've gotten ideas from the public. Over at our botanical gardens, this is probably the single most asked about plant, the angel wing begonia.
Okay.
Because it's a begonia, it's recognized as a begonia. People know begonias. But this begonia has silver spots on the leaves, and it looks like some little kid has come along with finger paint.
Yeah, is this the same thing as the polka dot begonia?
Polka dot begonia.
Okay. And what's the take the microphone with me? What's the point of these little polka dots all over the leaves?
That's the question. What's the point?
Well, we think it's actually camouflage. Yes, I know. It sticks out like a sore thumb. But so does someone wearing camouflage walking through the mall. But you put them in the forest and they blend in. And so in the forest floors of rainforests where these begonias grow naturally, you can imagine little points of light coming through the canopy and creating patterns on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
This plant would actually blend in. Because plants are always under attack by animals. They've found many, many ways to protect themselves, and camouflage is one of them. And we believe that this plant is actually trying to camouflage itself.
Laura also wants to know if night blooming primrose is in your book, because they are her favorite weed.
No, we don't have any night blooming.
Are they weird?
No, there are a lot of plants that bloom at night. We do have the Christmas star orchid that is fragrant at night and is pollinated by hawk moths. And there are other night blooming plants.
But that does get to a point that there are many, many plants that didn't make the cut of the book. It was really hard to decide. And so the whole class of night-blooming plants are in some ways weird. The whole class of plants that have black flowers are weird, but we had to be selective.
Now, you brought, I think this is what, you brought a little pot of a plant that looks like rocks.
Yes, those are the living stones. They come from South Africa or Southern Africa. And they grow in very dry deserts, and they mimic rocks so that they can hide from predators, because they're little nuggets of water, and they would be juicy little morsels for desert plants, for desert animals who are looking for water. So they have no other protection. They have no spines. They have no poisonous juices. They can only rely on hiding from predators.
And yet, one of them that you brought today is in bloom, and so there goes the camouflage.
Yes, there's a weakness in every ploy, and all organisms sooner or later have to reproduce. They have to make flowers or spores, and they have to get pollinated, and so they have to have showy flowers for pollination. So for a brief period in the year, less than a month, these flowers sort of stick their necks out, literally, and make flowers that are showy and attractive, and hope that the wrong animals don't see them.
A couple of plants in the book you did not bring, because there are a lot more plants in the books than you brought. The beehive ginger plant, which looks like a beehive, yes, but to me it looks more like a pine cone.
Yeah.
Is it ginger?
It is related to the culinary ginger. So culinary ginger that we eat has not such showy cones, but there's a whole slew of tropical plants that are gingers, and so it's a relative. And it's actually sometimes called pine cone ginger, and it is used in flower arrangements. So you may have actually seen it in a flower arrangement as a cut flower from tropical Southeast Asia. And so they make it all the way across the world here to sit on our tables.
And then there's a plant in the book that looks exactly like a tortoise shell.
Yes.
I mean, it really does. And it's called what? The tortoise?
Well, we call it the tortoise shell Dioscorea.
Mm-hmm.
Its Latin name is Testudinaria, which means turtle.
Yeah.
And that's the stem of the plant. It would in nature grow underground. And when we grow it in cultivation, we want to see those patterns. And so we grow it above ground. And what you're looking at is almost like bark.
Yeah.
Those patterns on there, they grow regularly every year and get bigger and bigger, just like the rings of a tree of trees.
There's also another striking plant, the lifesaver plant. It's striking.
Yeah, that's the flower of a desert plant. And it has that rim around the inside of the flower that looks like a lifesaver. We don't know what that's for.
Really?
All of these plants, Mike.
Is it sticky? It looks sticky.
No, it's smooth. It's waxy.
Mm-hmm. Shiny.
But everything we talk about has some function. We don't always know what that function is.
Do they have a fragrance, these flowers?
Yes, they stink.
Yeah.
Now, flies are attracted to
flowers that stink. To flowers that stink. And the flowers make that smelly, that nasty smell for the purpose of attracting flies as pollinators. And they're looking and smelling like rotten meat, which the flies are looking for to lay eggs.
Several people have asked, since some of these plants are going to be on display at the Botanical Garden at UNC Charlotte, are some of these plants for sale? Can you buy plants while you're there?
No, you'd have to come to our spring plant sale. Okay. We may have some fly traps for sale, but these are available from the Internet, and so people can look for them.
We will continue to have pictures of these plants and flowers on our website and our Facebook page. The book, though, is called Bizarre Botanicals by Larry Melichamp and Paula Gross, our guests today. Thanks for joining us and bringing all these plants.
It was fun.
Thanks, Mike. Charlotte.